Surprisingly, Meta and Google have said they're going to appeal the decision. I mean, can you ever convince the companies themselves that it's a good thing to regulate them to protect our children?
Regulation is absolutely key.
Yeah, but will they ever be convinced about that? The companies.
Well, it's not a case of whether they'll be convinced. I mean, I think what the watershed moment is with this trial is that it sends a message to the advertising industry, as in the people that are working in this industry. Mm. You know, these people are parents, they have children, and there is no question around the harms of the online environment for children now as a result of this case. And that the fact that, you know, what we've always been talking about over the last few years of how addictive these sites are and how these platforms are addictive for children. So the advertising industry themselves, as in those parents, those individuals, will now have to take a look at themselves. And that's where the change will come.
Dr. Karen Middleton, senior lecturer in marketing at the University of Portsmouth, an expert witness in the UK government's inquiry into social media. Thank you very much for bringing us to the end of The Times at One. And that's it from me for this week. Thank you so much for keeping me company. On Times at One next week, it's Andrew Neil. But right now, get ready for Jane Garvey and Lee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And on the programme today, Donald Trump keeps insisting Iran wants a peace deal. It doesn't seem quite so sure. We'll talk to a former US envoy about negotiating with Tehran. Would you let your child play with a My First Influencer kit? The former AI minister has told Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mikhailova, she'd be fine with the idea. More on that a little bit later. Bassus the Great is back with the sport. Could the dream of the fan-owned, high-performing football club be on the way out? And our big interview is all about siblings. The author, Catherine Carr, has written a great book on the subject. It's called Who's the Favourite?
All after the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Israel have confirmed the death of Ali Reza Tangsiri, the commander of Iran's IRGC Navy. Benjamin Netanyahu said the commander had a great deal of blood on his hands. Elsewhere, President Trump has accused NATO of doing absolutely nothing to help with the war on the lunatic nation of Iran, as he calls it. NATO's chief has avoided criticising Trump in return, saying they do have joint aims.
NATO has for some time been clear. Iran cannot possess a nuclear weapon. And NATO has also long recognised the threat Iran's missile programme posed to allies and their interests. Iran has now capabilities increasingly dangerous for allies.
Mark Rutte speaking there. President Trump has also said Tehran should be begging for a deal. Meanwhile, Germany warned the war is a catastrophe for the world's economies and demanded a ceasefire. The boss of one of Britain's largest banks has been sacked after failing to pay out almost £500 million belonging to dead customers over 17 years. Pensions Minister Torsten Bell announced his removal to the Commons, adding the NS&I didn't fully respond to previous warning signs. Former HMRC boss Sir Jim Hara will replace Dax Harkins as a chief executive on an interim basis. A double murderer who stabbed his pregnant girlfriend to death while on licence for an earlier killing will spend the rest of his life behind bars. Shane March was originally handed a minimum 42 years for killing Alana Odysseus in East London in July 2024. The 48-year-old had previously stabbed a teenager at a McDonald's in 2000. At the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Edis upgraded his sentence.
The sentence was unduly lenient. We quash it and we quash the minimum term order that the judge made. The offender will never be released.
Following a landmark trial in the US, the Prime Minister says he's keen to tackle the addictive features of social media. A jury has ruled Google and Meta were responsible for a young woman getting addicted on its platforms. Katie Heyman-Joyce is from the Molly Rose Foundation, named after the 14-year-old who ended her life after being exposed to a torrent of harmful content online.
We knew 4 years ago, after Molly's inquest, that Meta, their business models, were actively causing children harm. This is a wake-up call to the tech firms to listen.
Transgender women athletes have been banned from competing in all-female events at the Olympics. The IOC says eligibility will now be limited to biological females, determined on the basis of a one-time gene test. No woman who transitioned from being born male competed at the 2024 Paris Summer Games. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, Thursday campers. I'm Fee Glover. She's Jane Garvey. We're with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Coming soon, we'll be visualised. And I've just done a very almighty stretch in the radio studio, Jane, that in days to come, it just won't happen, will it? Nobody wants to turn in, look at the YouTube channel and see somebody doing some calisthenetics or whatever called.
It looked pretty good to me, to be honest.
Do you have a fancy little stretch just before the broadcasting starts?
Yeah, I do, actually.
A little limbering up.
Yeah, let's get in position.
And
which makes it sound more interesting than it is. But anyway, what have we got today?
We're going to start with age verification in porn. Not to watch it, but to make it. And we will give you a little bit of extra warning on that one if you're on the school run and little ears are listening. If that is the case, though, you can definitely re-engage with the programme at about 20 minutes past two for the next item, which will be a celebration of baked beans. How has the Heinz bean made it through 140 years, seemingly never going out of fashion? Here's a question of modern times for you as well today. Would you want your kids to be influencers? And would you be happy to buy them a toy influencer set? So presumably that has a microphone, a phone, one of those ring lights, and 10,000 imaginary followers. I don't quite know what would be in the kit. One Labour MP thinks it is totally fine, but an awful lot of parents aren't really so sure. The Saturday magazine will be promoted by Chief Saturday Girl. That's Jane Mulkerins. She'll be here just before 3 o'clock. After three, we will return to the all-important topic of what on earth is happening in Iran. And after 3:30...
our guest this afternoon is Catherine Carr, who's written a book called Who is the Favourite? The Loving, Messy Realities of Sibling Relationships. Now, you could be an only child. You may be the youngest of four. You could be in the middle of five. You could be the elder of two children, whatever it is. However your family has played out, it will have had an impact on you and the way you are. And Catherine Carr interrogates all this brilliantly in, I think, one of the... I don't think I've ever read a book before about siblings, sibling relationships, birth order, and the impact of it all on the way you are as an individual.
Do you not read Cain and Abel?
By Jeffrey Archer.
Isn't that
I have
brothers?
Read that.
Yeah.
Yes, I have read that.
Yeah,
I mean,
so you have.
It's funny how books by Jeffrey Archer don't always linger in the way they should. Which isn't to say they're not astonishing.
Why would that be?
I don't know, Fee. So Catherine Carr is our guest after 3:30. If you've had siblings and you've maybe wrestled with them, if you don't think your siblings like you, if you don't like them, or if you're an only child and you're perfectly happy with it, we're all in this mix somewhere, aren't we? I'd love to hear from you. Tell me about your sibling situation and the way it has... if indeed it has, impacted on your life. But I refuse to believe that it doesn't impact on you. I definitely think it does.
Well, it's one of those intriguing things, isn't it? That, you know, none of us can ever go back and do it differently.
No.
So if you think it hasn't impacted you, you've got no way of knowing that, really.
No.
But we're pretty sure that it must have done somewhere along the line.
There must be loads of only so-called only children. Even that, it feels like a weighty phrase. It feels loaded somehow, almost judgmental.
I think it's very judgmental for the only child.
As though they have any say in it.
Exactly. And as soon as you say only child, I think what you're then creating is quite a catalogue of doom-laden aspects of life, not celebratory aspects of life. So there's plenty to talk about there. And of course, the only child is more and more common. In previous generations, it wouldn't have been, but with a falling birth rate, that is so many people
and
on the planet.
It is, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, that... sometimes older children are regarded as being perhaps more dutiful and more responsible. It's a bit of a cliche, but it also seems to apply even when the children in question are twins or triplets. and they may only be older by a minute and a half or 3 minutes, which is simply absurd, isn't it? But there are also, I don't know, just expectations of people depending on the order in which they were born.
And the funny twin thing, often said as well, is that the twin who is regarded as older because they come out first is not the twin who is older in terms of when the actual, what's the word I'm searching for, occurred?
Fertilisation.
Let's go with that.
That. I'd rather not go with it.
Well, not when you're on air. So plenty to talk about this afternoon. We're 0333 002 353. We're Jane and Fee at times.radio. The most read stories on the Times website so far today. In at number 3, 10 things we learnt from explosive new book about Harry and Meghan. Tom Bauer offers an unsparing portrayal in Betrayal, from Meghan's brainwashing of Harry to corporate weariness over the prince's victimhood. The second most read story, as war bites at home, are Russian loyalists turning on Putin. Mark Bennett writes that casualties, rising costs and rare dissent from Kremlin loyalists do point to a shift in mood, even if strict controls stifle any wider backlash. And the most read piece on the Times website, Iran war latest strike kills Navy chief overseeing Strait of Hormuz blockade. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy had blood on his hands. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Karen's weighing in already and has this. My dad always said I was his favourite as I was the eldest. Cut to 2017 when sadly he died and left everything to my sister, not even a mention in the will, you see. Karen's in Bridgend. Right. These are complex areas, and of course we've no way of knowing exactly what was going on in your dad's head, Karen.
But we would like to.
We very much like to. So do keep your thoughts on siblings and birth order coming in, Karen. Catherine Carr is joining us after 3:30. Now, there's been a push in Parliament to crack down on pornography websites, and this is the item in the programme that you may wish to avoid if you are currently caring for or in the presence of a younger person. New rules would force sites to verify the age and consent of people who are in the videos. Now, this follows a review by Baroness Burton, which exposed major gaps in regulation and made more than 30 recommendations. The proposed measures are part of the Crime and Policing Bill, which is in its final stages. We can talk now to Naomi Miles, who's founder of the Centre to End All Sexual Exploitation. CEASE is the charity, isn't it, Naomi? Hello, good afternoon to you.
Right. Hello, thank you so much.
Now, tell me, what are the proposals for age and consent verification checks?
Well, yes, these seem very fundamental, I think. The pornography industry has been woefully under-regulated, actually. So they're fundamental, but they're fairly radical. They'd be a game changer for the many victims out there. We know that mainstream pornography websites are absolutely awash with illegal and non-consensual material. There was a big 2020 trafficking campaign that had survivor testimonies and various court cases that had just this massive bank of evidence showing the scale of the problem. So these proposals would mean that porn sites would just have the responsibility for checking that everyone who features in their videos is a consenting adult and also gives their consent on an ongoing basis as well. So they have the right to withdraw that consent at any point.
Right. I mean, I don't doubt you, but I just need to know from you, Naomi, how you know that so much of this content does feature people who are not of age and were not in any position to give consent.
Yes. I've heard many survivor testimonies, actually, and once you hear them, they have a massive impact. There have been some really important, successful lawsuits, actually, against Pornhub and its parent company. There are some that are still ongoing, some real class actions where individuals have come together as a collective to seek justice. So these are people who've had material posted without their knowledge or consent. Perhaps they have been raped, and that has been recorded and posted directly onto the website. Maybe they were coerced or trafficked into the porn industry. That happens. A lot of porn sites these days, they're tube-style platforms, so anyone can upload anything directly onto the platform with minimal checks. So it's not studio-produced by and large, although that is poorly regulated as well. But the very business model sort of depends on economies of scale. So they want as much content as possible. They are not particularly fussy about where it comes from.
Okay, I think Pornhub, because you happen to reference them, would say that they were doing their best to make absolutely certain that everything is above board. And indeed, they are cooperating with the government. What do you think of that?
That's right. They are about the only porn platform that has got something rather than nothing.
Right.
Which is important
to acknowledge, isn't it?
It's important to acknowledge that their hand has been forced effectively on the back of the Trafficking Hub campaign that I mentioned. Visa and MasterCard withdrew their support for the platform, and they're faced with huge astronomical legal costs. So they have to do something. They're recognising that this is in their best interest. So it's good, but it's not come from nowhere.
What about situations in which a person, a woman or a girl, may have given her consent and may well have been over 18 at the time she did so, but might actually have been coerced into doing so, or might have been at a vulnerable point in her life and not been able to see that she was actually doing something she might well regret?
Absolutely. Well, this is very common, actually. This is something. So the government has previously said it doesn't think these laws are practical, that where material is produced legally, it should be treated like any other kind of commercial media governed by copyright law. It's very, very different. It's not simulated. There are no body doubles. It is raw and real and very, very exposing. And actually, it's very complicated because in many cases, individuals will believe that they're entering into this through their own volition. They're choosing this. It's a decision they are making. They don't understand the various factors that are at play. As you reference, a lot of them come from backgrounds of vulnerability. They've suffered difficult childhood experiences. Often they've suffered some kind of sexual abuse as well. And there are coercive partners and influences in their life. Decisions are not made in a vacuum. And it often takes a while for them to realise that. But the nature of this is that once material is uploaded, once it's on the internet, it's almost impossible to get it back again. It follows them for the rest of their days and has such a profound, long-lasting and devastating impact on them.
That is a really gloomy prospect. So in truth, even though you might well be able to take content off one site, it is likely to pop up somewhere else.
That's exactly right. Yes, it is copied, it's re-uploaded across multiple different platforms, even across different jurisdictions. So that is an ongoing problem, even for Pornhub and the major sites. Yeah, I've got a survivor friend who asked someone to flag and remove the content. They asked the moderator to flag and remove her content. It was created through coercion and trafficking. And it was almost instantly reposted with a slightly changed title, a couple of seconds shaved off the ends. And then it gets passed again. So even on the same platforms, it can be reposted again and again.
This is deeply gloomy stuff, isn't it, actually? And I think it's just worth saying, perhaps asking you, what difference this would make if, for example, somebody was of age. So let's say it was a woman of 20, but a very young-looking woman of 20, and she was dressed in a way that might suggest that she was, for example, in full-time education. I mean, that content is there, isn't it?
That content is there. Actually, we're looking to... there's another amendment that has also been passed in the law that is trying to prohibit that. It's actually prohibited in offline pornography. That's all regulated by the BBFC. But historically, online pornography has been a bit of a wild west. There have been very, very few standards. And it really does normalise behaviours we know are outrageous and harmful and wrong.
I was talking recently to the Times journalist Helen Rumbelow, who's written some very, very powerful stuff over the last couple of years about porn and about the nature of porn and how it's changed. And it is without a shred of doubt that today's porn does show almost nothing, and I'm talking mainstream, entirely legal porn, almost nothing about female pleasure or the possibility of it, but simply hours of things being done to women, which is not sex and not what any of us would understand as making love. So what do we do about this?
Well, this is, it's kind of the way that porn sites are set up. I think we can be very desensitized. So the fact that it's free and easily accessible to anyone means that very quickly users will become desensitized to explicit material. And those porn sites need to maximize user engagement. They make their money off subscriptions and advertising. So they will try to keep that user engaged and aroused by feeding them more extreme and hardcore and violent material. This creates what we call escalation pathways that can lead people to very dark places, actually, where they seek after child sexual abuse material and all sorts of other illegal content. And it's very difficult to see how we can come back from that, actually. It really does shape our sexual tastes and preferences. It doesn't just reflect them. It changes how we think about sex and pleasure and the opposite sex. And it's having a profound damaging effect on the consumers as well.
Naomi, can I ask a question and forgive my relative ignorance about this, but why would the assumption be made that in order to keep somebody on a platform, they would always want to see rougher, nastier sex? Where has that come from?
I think it's what makes the money, actually. so
it is absolutely a proven pathway.
It is, yes. The porn sites are expert at A/B testing and at algorithmic engagement. They know what will keep people watching. And unfortunately, it is the more violent, hardcore, aggressive, nasty stuff that people need after a while. And often it won't align with their wider values. What they watch online, they're often quite ashamed about, because genuinely they believe in sex equality and they think it's wrong to treat women like that. But their brain is wired in such a way that they've been kind of led down this path.
Very, very briefly, Naomi, because this is fascinating and so important. What happened in the House of Lords yesterday?
Well, the House of Lords has passed and accepted these amendments, which is absolutely fantastic news. They weren't actually debated yesterday, I don't believe. We stood outside Westminster with a group of supportive cross-party MPs, and it's just wonderful to see how much cross-party support this has. It's kind of politics at its best. And we are just really urging the government to accept this amendment or a version of it. And the government does seem to be listening, actually. It is paying attention. Well, this has a lot of support from wider civic society and a broad kind of range of different organisations as well. So it's encouraging to see the direction of travel.
Thank you. Really appreciate your time. Naomi Miles, founder of the Centre to End All Sexual Exploitation charity. Quick statement from the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. We remain determined to tackle dangerous and degrading pornography as part of our mission to halve violence against women and girls within a decade.
Now, you cannot fault us for our dedication to bringing you light and shade. Coming up next, how long have Brits been eating baked beans? It is 22 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
It's rowing's greatest rivalry. 197 years of history, drama and sporting prowess. And this April, Times Radio will bring you live and exclusive coverage of the 2026 Oxford versus Cambridge boat race. Hear all the build-up to the race across the Times Radio schedule, culminating in a special program on the 4th of April to bring you stroke-by-stroke coverage of both the men's and the women's races live. The Boat Race, coming soon, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Cathay Pacific brings you closer to Asia. From Hanoi's vibrant streets to Bali's serene shores, indulge in world-class service, savor Michelin-star dining, and lose yourself in our award-winning in-flight entertainment. Cathay Pacific. Move beyond.
This was made with human intelligence.
And artificial intelligence.
Just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50K from April 2026, making tax digital means...
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has...
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. I'll do it with Intuit QuickBooks.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost. Because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas. And Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So somewhere in your kitchen, there is a can of baked beans going, yeah, it is my birthday. It's celebrating 140 years, hopefully, not sitting in your kitchen. Once a luxury import at Fortnum & Mason, this essential toast accessory is now a staple of the British diet with 2 million cans polished off every day. Let's discuss the legacy of tangy, tomatoey treasures with Polly Russell, food historian, who joins us now.
What did you call them?
Tangy, tomatoey treasures.
Okay. Hello. Good second mention there.
Hello, Polly. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Are you a fan of the baked bean yourself?
I am. I really like, I like eating them myself, but also I've got three kids and I'm not, I mean, they're older now and they can sort of make their own beans on toast, thank the Lord. But there was a period when they were young. I'm not quite sure how I could have parented without them.
Yes, I would completely agree. I'm not sure that a kitchen is a kitchen without an emergency can of Heinz baked beans in it. How have they lasted so long, though, and never really been knocked out of their place in the kitchen by a food fad or dietary requirements changing or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I mean, that length of time, 140 years for a brand, is pretty phenomenal. And as you say, one that's sort of remained in favour and is in fact a, really a staple of sort of British diet. And I think it's to do with a few things, but the main thing is that I think how versatile the baked bean is. That it really, you can adapt it in all sorts of ways. So it can be, you know, breakfast, lunch, tea, a snack. And so it's got this kind of elasticity in how you can use it. And then also it's sort of, as society's changed, as we've kind of culturally changed, it's sort of come along with us. It's sort of managed to fit in at different times across history and provide a sort of essential food that's very easy, that's convenient, that's known to be safe. So I think it sort of fulfills these functions. And then it's also very comforting because so many of us have long associations with it from our childhoods through to growing up to then, you know, having families, perhaps it has a very sort of nostalgic, comforting familiarity. So it sort of hits all these points. And I think that accounts for its longevity.
Are baked beans good for you, or are they actually covered in a gooey, salty, sugary thing that's not very good for you, Polly?
Well, I probably defer to a nutritionist for the definitive answer on that. But as a food historian, what I'd say is in a can of beans. So what a can of beans is a sort of meal in a can. It's got a lot of fibre. It's got protein. It is warming. It's nutritious. And I'm thinking of it kind of historically, you know, particularly in the 20s when they were first really being branded to and sold to urban populations, urban working populations. This was a sort of miracle product to have almost a whole meal in a can where all you had to do was heat it up and you would be able to have a full, warming, nutritious meal. And also, you didn't have to have meat. I think that's also really important, that meat across the last 100 years at different times has been expensive or hard to get during wartime. And so beans provide a sort of source of protein. So I'm not going to give you a nutritionist's answer, but they certainly pack a lot of what we need in terms of nutritional content.
And let's go back 100 years. So let's say the can of baked beans in 1926 in this country, how would it have been served and on whose table would it have been served?
Great question, because when they were first sold in Britain, they were imported by Henry J. Hines. He was American from Pennsylvania, a food entrepreneur, and the Hines company imported them to Britain and they sold them through Fortnum and Mason initially. So they started off their life in Britain very much associated with an elite sort of high-end retailer in London. But by the 1920s, Hines had a factory that was producing the product. And then it was very much a shift towards marketing for the working urban population of cities. And they were sold under the branded Ready and Sustaining. So this idea that you can finish a day of work and they'll suddenly be ready, they're ready and available and they'll sustain you. Don't require a huge amount of fuel to heat up, don't need a fridge, etc. And so then they're being sold as either a meal on itself, like a bowl of beans, or that you start to see advertising with toast. So that starts to be part of how we eat them.
It's a fascinating conversation. I wish we had longer. That's the food historian, Polly Russell. How do you like yours?
White toast, quite a lot of butter, half a can of beans, and then some cheddar cheese on top with a bit of pepper.
It's absolutely lovely.
Ultimate meal.
Absolutely lovely. I would only change that to brown bread underneath.
Well, that's the difference.
It is the difference between us, darling. And I've put an awful lot of Worcester sauce on top as well. Ooh, which is not just a magic kind of extra bite to it too. And I quite like the ones that have the vegetarian sausages in them now. As well. And that tells you everything you need to know about the daftness of my existence.
It does a bit, but also the when they're not vegetarian, the little sausagey things that you used to get.
Yes,
what was that?
You said sausagey things.
Well, because I'm not sure that
I think they were sausage adjacent, weren't they?
Yeah, yes, they were.
Anyway, many, many happy returns to Heinz Baked Beans.
Thank you. And if you're a food product and it's your birthday coming up, let us know about it. Spurious item on the whole subject.
Oh, we needed something distracting. I don't mind it was baked beans at all.
Next, would you let your child play with an influencer kit? You're with Times Radio. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has lashed out at NATO again while saying Tehran should be begging to make a deal. The US president claims the alliance has done nothing to help in his war with Iran. Meanwhile, Pakistan's foreign minister says indirect discussions are taking place between the warring nations. Iran appears to have rejected a 15-point peace plan from the US. Military analyst Sean Bell says Tehran's come up with five proposals.
Reparations for the damage that's been done to Iran. Talks about recognising Iranian sovereignty, the Straits of Hormuz. Things that America are clearly not going to be able to do. So it's clearly not worth the paper it's written on. It's almost like a sort of bit of belligerence, I suspect, there. It's still a gulf between them.
The International Olympic Committee has announced it's banning athletes born male from competing in all female events. The restriction applies to eligibility for any female category event at the Games, including individual and team sports. A labourer who killed a mother of two and buried her in woodland near Coventry has been jailed for 18 years. Mohamed Journeon was cleared of murder at Warwick Crown Court on Tuesday, but found guilty of manslaughter over the death of 33-year-old Rhianne Coulson. The pensions minister has also told MPs compensation will be paid over the NS&I scandal where appropriate. A new leadership team is in place at the savings giant, where 37,000 account holders have been affected by money mismanagement and poor customer service. And the Murder, She Wrote movie will be released in time for Christmas 2027. The film adaptation stars Jamie Lee Curtis as amateur crime sleuth Jessica Fletcher. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
All right, we've got Simon on the line. Simon, young people, they're just all a bit lazy, aren't they?
What do you think?
Welcome to McDonald's.
Can I get 6 minutes, please?
Of course.
Some say young people are work shy, but at McDonald's, we hired 47,000 of them last year.
Thank you very much. So, how's your
night? Like George here, who keeps things running during a Friday rush. Resilience, making it happen at McDonald's.
The to-do list. Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Let Wix install your new kitchen. Choose from a wide range of kitchens and add the option of installation to your order. For complete peace of mind, all installations include a 2-year workmanship guarantee. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So our guest after 3:30 is Catherine Carr, who's written a book about siblings and sibling relationships called Who's the Favourite? And some interesting stuff from you on this. Alison says, I'm the youngest of three, the only girl with two older brothers. We're all nearly or over 60, all very different people. We've lived very different lives. But the dynamic when together has always devolved to when we were children. So this has always been laughable, if childish. But now that our parents are ailing, and I was the one chosen to have power of attorney, the feeling of entitlement just because of the birth order rankles, and it's causing resentment at a time when I think we should all be pulling together. It's hard, but it's time for me to step up from the picked-on little sister role to be the advocate my parents wanted me to be. That's interesting, Alison. I know sometimes it's said that when parents start to age, it tends to be the daughters who end up doing the bulk of the work. Not always, but it certainly is something that has been mentioned actually by another WhatsApper as well this afternoon. So keep your thoughts coming on sibling relationships, where you are in birth order and whether you think it's significant or not. 0333 003 2353. Now, a Labour MP and former AI minister has told Times Radio that she'd be happy to let her children play with a quite controversial toy influencer kit. And she's also said it's a valid career choice. Ferial Clark is one of the MPs serving on a new inquiry into the role played by online content creators in the economy. Now, the government is thinking about consulting, is currently consulting, I apologise, on whether to ban access to social media for the under-16s. The MP for Enfield North made those comments in an interview with Times Radio's political editor, Anna Mihailova. And Anna joins us now from Westminster. So just explain all. What is an influencer kit, Anna?
Good afternoon. So this week, Argos launched a kit for children, like a play, toy play set made out of wood, which includes a ring light, a microphone, an iPad and a phone. So effectively for children to play, dress up as mini influencers. And it's marketed at children aged 2 and up. And caused, I think it's fair to say, an absolute storm on Mumsnet, on mum groups, and in public discourse, with campaigners coming out to say that this is absolutely not what we should be giving our children in an age when screen time is already such a problem. But I spoke to an MP on the day that a group of parliamentarians, MPs and Lords, have launched an inquiry into the benefits of content creators or influencers.
Well, let's hear Ferial Clark herself. Here she is telling you why she isn't worried about her children playing with this kit.
No, God, no. I mean, my little one has lots of mermaids. Do I think she's going to turn into a fish? Is she supposed to be a fish? No, she doesn't. And I don't think my little ones will know what a ring light is, but they certainly know what a microphone is, and I've got a couple of them. Oh, my God. I wish I hadn't bought them for them. But it's incredibly loud. But, I mean, I think we've got to be careful about, as I said, not, you know, everyone who owns who does content with a ring light and with a camera, with a phone, with a stand, isn't trying to sell you hair products or makeup. And good luck, you know. As I said, we are targeted as consumers by every industry through loads of different means. And social media influencers is just one of those avenues. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with... I mean, I don't think my child will ever know what a PR person... You know, what's a PR person look like? And people, you know, lots of companies use PR companies to advertise lots of the toys that we end up buying. If my daughter wanted it, I don't have a problem with it. Like, I don't think she's going to want to. I said, if she wants to teach maths or French and be an influencer on that, or sell makeup, or be a journalist, I would be happy with that.
Or be a journalist. That's Ferial Clark, MP. My colleague here, Fee, has just been looking at the price of these influencer kits. How much are they?
So the influencer kit that's available at Argos, it's made by Chad Valley. It's £15. That's £15. It's all wooden. You get a camera and a microphone, a ring light, a bag that you can keep your ego in, a little mobile phone and an iPad as well. And you can also buy from Chad Valley a spa kit. Or you could get a wooden astronaut set as well.
Right.
Those are the things that are most frequently bought together with the influencer kit.
Oh, quite surprised that the astronaut is... Anyway, well, why not? Go aim for the stars. Were you a bit surprised by Ferial Clark's relatively positive, I thought, to be honest, rather down-to-earth attitude to the whole idea of the influencer kit?
Well, I wasn't surprised because I know that I know her views on the influencer economy, and she is trying to get the government in its plans to look at the effects of social media and potentially banning social media. She's trying to argue against the negatives that are often talked about and actually sell the positive case. And the positive case in her mind is that they do increasingly contribute to the economy. They are a source of jobs because content creators often employ a bunch of people as well. And she also talked a lot about influencers who are also maths teachers and educators, and that she would be more than happy for her two very young children to end up aspiring to be those. And I, you know, you say relatable. I agree with that. And it's always refreshing when you speak to a politician who isn't concerned about weighing into a topic that is controversial, that will obviously spark a lot of parents saying that they are completely wrong, because a lot of people have very strong views about this. She acknowledged that, you know, parents will be concerned that the industry is trying to encourage children onto social media with this toy. So she acknowledges that point. But she also says that as a young mom during COVID, she herself found a lot of comfort in YouTube videos. So when essential services like health visits for breastfeeding advice and the kind of groups that take place to help young mums get acquainted with motherhood, all of those weren't working during COVID when she had her kids. Mm. And she literally just watched YouTube tutorials by nurses and people on that. So she sees personally the benefits.
Yeah. Well, and there are many benefits. I think I've certainly heard said by a number of people who know more about it than me that influencing can be a really lucrative source of income. For example, a single mother who perhaps couldn't work conventional office or factory hours, but could produce content at a time that suited her. And that can lead to, you know, a certain amount of career success and a half decent income. Let's talk about content creation that, frankly, is of a rather different sort. And we were talking earlier about trying to regulate the porn industry. And OnlyFans had gross revenues, I mean, this is astonishing, of more than $7 billion in 2024. So what about MPs' attitude towards what you might loosely call this sort of influencing? Because, again, huge amounts of money are being made here.
Well, that's the thing. And MPs who are campaigning for children not to be on social media, so the MPs who have been pushing for a ban, like Australia's introduced for under-16s, those are the examples they give. They talk about websites that have made porn so much more accessible and all the concerns around that industry, that availability. For children to easily find content that can be really dangerous. And, you know, we're not saying that that is the bulk of what OnlyFans and such websites are. And obviously those websites would say that they take down content that breaches their guidelines. But the real concern is that, you know, children as young as 8 can be shown content that is completely inappropriate towards them. So the MPs campaigning for changes and tighter regulation very much say that arguments like Ferriol's just made are completely irrelevant here, because just because there are some benefits, you should be looking at those damaging consequences and not allowing them to happen.
Yeah, and I, slightly going off the point, but what about those children who are used by their parents in momfluencer-type posts? They can't possibly give consent. In some cases, they can't speak. But that content is out there forever, presumably. And they might feel when they get to 17 or older that they don't want it out there, and they're rather angry that they were ever used in the first place.
Well, indeed. And the counter argument to that is you've always had journalists who make a career of writing about their kids. There have been some famous examples over the years. I remember that woman who wrote about putting her daughter on a diet, I think it was in the 90s, and that had sparked a massive debate about whether that was appropriate to use your kids in that way. And people would argue that social media is just another medium for doing that sort of thing, but of course on a much wider scale. You know, I think, you know, when it comes to legislating and parliament, it looks a lot like the government is keen to hear these arguments about the more positive sides of social media in their consultation. And there's not that much appetite among ministers for an Australia-type ban. So that consultation is going to conclude in the summer and we'll see where it goes. But I think an actual ban at this stage looks pretty unlikely.
That's probably at odds with the way most members of the public think, isn't it?
Well, I think when you hear parents, a lot of parents assume a ban is already happening just because they know that there was some legislation put forward in the Lords. But I doubt many of them are following it that closely and know that that legislation was voted down in the Commons.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Anna Mihailova, who is Times Radio's political correspondent. You and I, well, I think you'll admit that you played radio stations when you were, I certainly did.
Yes, and actually, my kids' favourite game was using a piece of equipment that I'd had stashed away at my house in times of trouble from the BBC days, which was a microphone, a set of faders and a long wire that went nowhere. And that was, they could spend hours and hours. So I can see the attraction of the influencer kit. I suppose my slight problem with condemning it is if a child sees that going on around them, it is always good to role play, isn't it? You don't have to automatically assume that everything that you role play as a kid, you're going to want to do as an adult. And there just are lots of people, as you said, making, you know, really decent money doing something, you know, promoting really good content. It's not all
misinformation, dreadful.
You know, there's an upside. There are some sunny uplands in this world
as
well.
People talking about kindness and compassion and things like that.
And how to clean a fridge, Jane.
And that's important too. Just worth saying that Anna Mikhailova is political editor, not political correspondent. Sorry about that. Okay, what have we got next? It's Mulkey Mulkerins, isn't it?
We're going to get a sneak peek into this weekend's edition of the Times magazine with Jane Mulkerins. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio, hosting an honest conversation about current affairs, well-being, lifestyle, health and wealth. Plus, don't miss Tomorrow's Home, highlighting how you can make your house more energy efficient. The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio, with the UK government's boiler upgrade scheme. You could upgrade your heating with a £7,500 heat pump grant. Visit gov.uk/cleanenergy to check eligibility.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop it.
At QuickFit, our customers drive away happy every time.
Get up.
Do we tickle their feet?
Stop.
No.
Oh, all right.
We just do our job, like having an excellent range of tyres to suit every car on the road.
Oh, that's good to know.
That's why our customers drive away happy. Quick Fit. Drive away happy every time.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Before we get to Jane Mulkerins, let's take a closer look at one of the regional winners in this year's Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Wales. Winner, Usk, Monmouthshire.
So, hello, my name is Christos Kyriakidis. I own two businesses here in Usk. We own the Ma Platter, specialising in Greek cuisine, cocktails, wines and beers, and then we own the gin distillery, Whitehead Distillery. So we live above the gin distillery, so local. So we went from Greece to Cyprus with the family. When we moved here, you know, we may feel welcome. The community is very, very close to each other. Everyone, you know, is helping each other. All the businesses working together and trying to help each other. We get lots of tourists here, lots of visitors, so it's good. It's peace and quiet here, so it's not like busy life like Cardiff and other cities, but it's nice to bring up a family. You know, everyone's looking after each other, and it's nice to work together and have a close-up community. All the customers know each other, you know, we know them, they know us, so it's nice, that personal touch. You can still come and have a nice Greek meal, you know, just take you back to Greece. There's no change here. So, yeah, you probably walked around, you've seen everything is independent, yeah? You've got lovely hotels, bars, restaurants, you know, lots of cafes, lots of businesses, garden centre down the road. You got the butcher in the square. It's good, yeah. We're grateful to the locals.
I'm Neil Lewis, and I'm the local butcher. Yeah, it's a lovely place to live. Very quiet. I love the conversations from the customers, yeah. A lot of people like to do their gardening. They got allotments. Say I'm the local football manager, so that comes into the conversation a lot as well. More defeats than wins, I'm afraid. Got a good rugby team and a good cricket side as well, so a lot of the conversations about that as well, to be honest, yeah, so it's good.
My name's Abby Mallon, and we've lived in Esk now for 5 years. Me and my husband, Jake, and our now six-day-old son, Rafferty. We're doing really well, and we're lucky to have everything on our doorstep, that we can literally walk out of our door with him in the pram and go for coffee and wander and take things slow. Everything is so accessible in Esk, and it is definitely that lifestyle, you know, you've got everything on your doorstep that you could possibly want, and it's a very easy way of living, and there's a lot of community around here as well, so we're just heading now for coffee to our local coffee shop, and you know, everything is just nice and everyone knows each other, and it is easy, very easy. We're very lucky, so hopefully that continues.
That was a quick look at Ask, this year's winner for Wales in the Sunday Times Best Places to Live, sponsored by Lloyds.
The Sunday Times Best Places to Live on Times Radio, sponsored by Lloyds. Spotlight on Wales. Winner, Usk, Monmouthshire.
Jane Mulcairns is here. Don't forget, you can have a whole 3 hours of Jane Mulcairns in your ears on Saturday afternoon between 1 and 4. But you come in your capacity as Associate Editor of the Saturday Times magazine today. Keep up, everybody.
Many hats.
And we've got so much to talk about and not enough time to talk about it. Jan Morris was quite a figure of the literary scene and also of the transitioning scene. And there's a huge piece in the Saturday Times magazine this week, which is really, it's heartbreaking in places, but also hugely informative about how times have changed.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm slightly embarrassed to say I didn't know an awful lot about Jan Morris before we had this piece. So there's a new book by Sarah Wheeler about Jan Morris's incredible life, and it includes some letters from Jan which hadn't been seen before, which give just amazing insights into what it was like to go through something like that in the 1970s. So Jan Morris had been travel writer primarily and a historian, but had been a member of Edmund Hillary's expedition to Mount Everest, and actually broke the news of the conquering of Everest in 1953 by Edmund Hillary for the Times. And reading that account of the trip and just sort of, you know, the level of fortitude and exposure and, you know, everything that that group went through is an amazing piece to read on its own. But when read in conjunction with what Jan Morris was going through personally and privately, it just makes for such extraordinary reading. And Morris, in this piece, you know, Sarah talks about how James Morris, as he was then, had spent much of his 30s, you know, trying to find someone to help him, really, and going around psychiatrists and sexologists, as they were, had gone to various people in Berlin. You know, there were people in Manhattan kind of doing quite pioneering work. But it wasn't easy to find someone who would help you. And I mean, just some of the treatment, I mean, aside from the physical treatment and the amount of pill, he talks about the amount of pills that were sort of taken before, you know, there was any kind of effect. But it was also health service policy for a married candidate, as Jan Morris was then, married to a woman, Elizabeth, from a candidate had to obtain a divorce before surgery would be allowed, and which just seems incredibly cruel. And then you had to live as the gender you felt you were before anyone would also begin treatment. And Jan Morris actually kind of made a second life, lived a double life in Oxford, away from his wife Elizabeth, in order to be considered a candidate for transitioning.
And Elizabeth does sound like a remarkable, remarkable character, but also Jan Morris's children. And just to read a tiny excerpt from the piece, and it's well worth reading, all of it. Morris asked the children to call her Jan. This was obviously in the 70s when she had made the transition. I remember saying, her daughter Suki recalls, she was six in 1970, that's a girl's name. Mummy told us it can be either. In Scandinavia, Jan can be either a man or a woman's name. But every time I said daddy, Jan refused to answer. Mm. I mean, it's just...
It's really heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking
and
stuff.
And also the wider cruelty. In April 1972, a story appeared in The Spectator announcing that Morris was to complete her transition in Casablanca. I mean, I know it was... People have been outed until quite recently, horrifyingly, but just to announce that someone was transitioning is just unthinkable. But there is a beautiful part towards the end of the piece about the letter home after the surgery, and Jan writes to Elizabeth just saying... I hope all the torments I've plagued you with over so many years, I hope this makes up for it. I don't know how to thank you for all of your kindness to me. I really am me. And it ends with Elizabeth sent roses, an enormous bouquet, which is just, it's such a moving piece and just made me want to read more of Jan Morris's work, actually, especially the travel work and the sort of expeditions.
Yes, yep. And I think she was prolific and he was prolific as well. So you got an awful lot to choose from. Nikki Hilton, gosh.
Wow.
Gosh, what a leap. Just your average it girl.
Yeah, Nikki Hilton, less famous because, I mean, slightly sort of less tearaway sister of Paris. The two grew up in the Waldorf Astoria, as you would when you're a great-granddaughter of Conrad Hilton. She has moved very far away from that kind of life. She married a Rothschild, everyone. I have a question. Do members of dynasties just marry each other because that's the only people they meet at sort of the polo and Closters and stuff? Because it's extraordinary. Her husband, who is the son of Amshaw Rothschild, who took his own life in 1996, and Anita Guinness, and his sisters Kate and Alice have previously been married to Ben and Zach Goldsmith, respectively. Can you just not marry a bin man?
Well, we had Zach in here. We liked him, didn't
oh,
we?
Oh, no, I'm not saying he's not lovely. We're big fans of the magazine as well. I'm just saying. And it's a tiny, tiny bit insular, maybe?
Yeah. The article is peppered with just the most fantastic detail about how... kind of normal Nikki Hilton sees her life, but yes, to everybody else it's not normal.
She lives in Notting Hill, everyone. Yeah. Now it's very quaint.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Yeah, she wanted her wedding to be somewhere convenient so people didn't have to get on shuttle buses. So they went to Kensington Palace.
Well, I mean, I do know the bus you get, and it's the number 9, isn't it, from the bus station in Hammersmith. It's an energy saving
bus. It's quite a big one.
Yeah, it is. Double deck.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Just to be completely accurate, mm-hmm. The orangery at Kensington Palace. Before members of the palace get in touch, Jane.
Okay, right. Gosh, I'm so glad you reassured me there. I was wondering. Donald Trump is conducting one of his very peculiar public cabinet meetings, and I think it's fair to say that the body language, everyone looks just a little bit worried. That's all I'll say about that. So we'll try and find out exactly what's been said. I think it's the usual inconsistent hyperbolic. if you can fill in the rest. But anyway, we'll catch you, bring you up to date with what's been discussed a little bit later. It is 3 o'clock. Donald Trump does keep insisting that Iran wants a peace deal. Iran not so sure, of course. We'll talk to a former US envoy about what it's like to negotiate with Tehran. Vassos Alexander is here with the sporting news. Does the dream of a fan-owned football club have to die if it wants to excel? And siblings, how well do you get on with yours? Does birth order matter? Our big interview today is with Catherine Carr on her new book, Who's the Favourite? Here's the news at 3 from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The US president has repeated his claim that Iran is begging him to make a deal. Donald Trump is chairing his cabinet meeting, saying he's overwhelmingly winning over Iran, who he describes as lousy fighters, but they're great negotiators. Iran has responded to Washington's 15-point plan with its own conditions, like an end to attacks and compensation for damage. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says indirect talks are underway.
No negotiations have happened until now. I say this with certainty, that we have no conversations with our American counterparts. But over the past few days, our American counterparts have begun sending messages through others, other countries that are our friends.
The Prime Minister, meanwhile, has warned Western nations are facing a war on two fronts. Meeting allies at a major European defence summit, Keir Starmer gave approval for British forces to begin seizing Russian Shadow fleet tankers. With global focus drifting back to Vladimir Putin, Christopher Steele, former head of MI6's Russia desk, says events in the Middle East are a gift for him.
This does two things fundamentally. Russia benefits from instability in the world and the world economy because it's trying to export its oil and gas and other raw materials, which are made scarce by conflicts in other regions. The price of oil has gone up, but also the US has, in its wisdom, decided to loosen the controls on oil, particularly relating to India, in fact, which is one of Russia's main customers.
There's a warning the UK economy will take the biggest hit compared to any other country in the G20 following the fallout from the war. An international economic group are forecasting a jump in the average rate of inflation this year from 2.5% to 4%. The Chancellor insists she has the right economic plan, but Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says the government isn't doing a good enough job to protect people here.
Energy is growth. Without it, our country dies. We need to get Britain working again. Labour's approach is killing jobs. It's making people's bills go sky high. Manufacturing is disappearing from the country.
In other news, transgender women athletes have been banned from competing in all female events at the Olympics. The IOC says eligibility will now be limited to biological females determined on the basis of a one-time gene test. No woman who transitioned from being born male competed at the 2024 Paris Summer Games. The Metropolitan Police says an off-duty officer has been involved in a verbal altercation at the scene of the recent anti-Semitic arson attack in North London. It says it happened when residents were making comments to journalists in Golders Green. The force says the matter has been referred to the Department of Professional Standards. And the government says compensation will be paid over the NS&I scandal where appropriate. More than 37,000 customers have been affected, including bereaved families missing out on money due and people told to call back in weeks through staffing issues. A new leadership team is now in place at the premium bond giant. Pensions Minister Torsten Bell told MPs a plan to resolve the public problems will be published in May.
The NS&I holds over £240 billion of savings belonging to 24 million customers. It is an organisation that is valued by those saving with it and by this government. Every penny of their savings are safe. And as always, they are 100% guaranteed by the Treasury.
For a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So we are going to talk about siblings and the position in your family that may or may not determine certain traits, characteristics and paths that you take in life. We were also in the last hour of the programme talking about role play when you're a kid and what that might mean your influences are further down the line. And Josh says, I used to cosplay as a hairdresser when I was a toddler. Heaven forbid that that's what I became. Fortunately for everybody, I'm now an IT consultant.
I don't know. I hope he's not being rude about hairdressers.
No, but I think if you're a very bad hairdresser, you can leave your mark, can't you? Maybe if you're a very bad IT consultant, I don't know.
Well, actually I think both can cause problems.
That didn't work. Right, it's 5 minutes past three. The UK will suffer the biggest hit out of all of the G20 nations from the war in the Middle East, according to the OECD. Donald Trump continues to claim a deal to end the fighting could be close and that the Iranian regime wants a peace deal.
Just so we set the record straight, because I've been watching the Wall Street Journal's fake news and all these stories that get printed like, oh, I want to make a deal. They are begging to make a deal, not me. They're begging to make a deal. And anybody that saw what was happening over there would understand why they want to make a deal.
Well, Iran has mocked Trump's overtures for a peace deal, rejecting the 15-point peace plan proposed yesterday. Indirect talks are taking place through Pakistan. Airstrikes continue, with Israel saying it has killed a key Iranian naval commander. Let's talk about all of this with Richard Nephew, who was the US Deputy Special Envoy to Iran and served as Joe Biden's coordinator on global anti-corruption efforts. And he is now a professor at Columbia University. Richard Nephew, a very good afternoon from us in London.
Britain. The little clip that we just heard there of Donald Trump, I wonder what you think we should make of that.
Well, look, I think in any of these kinds of conflicts, there's always a attempt to posture for leverage, right? Especially if you think negotiations are going to happen, you want to say they're the ones who want to deal, we're not the ones who want to deal. I think the reality is that the United States is signaling pretty hard that it's concerned about the global economic implications of continuing the conflict. You can see this in the decision to relieve sanctions on Iranian oil, kind of an amazing thing in the context of a quite significant military clash. I do think the Iranians probably want a deal too, but everyone at this point is trying to posture to make sure that they enter into those negotiations with the strongest sense of leverage.
Who do you think will blink first then?
Well, look, I think ultimately the United States has already blinked a bit with the sanctions relief that's given. I think the problem for both sides is less a blinking issue than a material issue. You know, the Iranians are going to at some point start exhausting their missile supply, maybe less so on the drone side. The United States is going to start running out of interceptors and certainly political will to continue with the conflict. So I think ultimately what will end up happening is a short-term ceasefire that both sides will say, neither of us blinked, and then we'll see whether or not they can actually get going with real negotiations.
How much, if at all, do you believe that President Trump is being influenced by what this is doing to his own ratings in America? Does he simply not care at the moment? He has felt in a strong enough position that he doesn't need to care? I mean, there are midterms on the horizon.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he has been kind of resistant to a lot of polls over the course of the last year. He's done a lot of things that are tremendously unpopular, whether you're talking about immigration raids, you're talking about the tariff policy, if you're talking now, obviously, about the conflict. I think what he's much more acutely interested in is the economic numbers. And I think the damage that's been done to stock markets, the damage that's been done in terms of oil prices has affected him. And I think you can see a lot of efforts to try and address those problems and the decisions that have been made and the statements that have been made. I think that's still going to be his priority. And ultimately, that's what's going to drive him to want to abandon the conflict at some point.
And he has said, hasn't he, quite recently, that he thought actually the economic impact of the campaign against Iran would have been much worse. Is that him just trying to sell us what eventually happened? Or do you believe him on that?
No, I think he's trying to sell what he wants us to believe. I think, you know, ultimately, if you're going to have a conflict with Iran, you're going to have damage that's done to oil and gas infrastructure. You're going to have damage that's done to passages to the Straits of Hormuz. These are all things that were anticipated by those of us who've been, you know, working on these issues. And I think it's an intrinsic part. Now, he may have an argument that by addressing this problem now, you've avoided it becoming a bigger one in the future. I'm not terribly convinced by that. I don't believe in, you know, burning down my house now because at some point there could be a fire. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, he's got the political ability to try and make a lot of his partners and allies believe the things that he says. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's using that currency.
Is it feasible for the Straits of Hormuz to operate for ships not seen as aggressors?
Not very much. The Iranians will still have the ability to target ships if they so choose, and they can do so using a variety of methods. You know, obviously, we've already seen drones and missile systems. We've also seen in the past their ability and willingness to use special forces, you know, coming from the IRGC. So, you know, ultimately, what needs to happen is Iran needs to stop doing these things, and it's either because they have to have their capacity to do so eliminated, which is very difficult and time consuming, or they have to choose not to do so. And that requires either a deal or a change in government. And this is part of the reason why this is proving so difficult, is that it's very difficult to make the Iranians stop doing something which is relatively cost free and easy for them to do from an access perspective.
Yeah. What's it like to sit across the table from the Iranians? I mean, Donald Trump has used some language, as he does, about the Iranians involved in any negotiations, I think calling them strange. What would you say?
I never found them terribly strange. I was dealing with, you know, people who are professional diplomats. You know, Abbas Araghchi, who's the foreign minister now, was one of the people involved in those negotiations. You know, Javad Zarif and some of the other senior officials were all people who had a lot of experience in international diplomacy. And I think they were quite versed in the customs and methods. I think the bigger issue, frankly, is that Iranians, to some extent, like the United States and others, believe pretty strongly in their system and the righteousness of their causes, and that makes them less resistant to concessions and demands than what the president may have anticipated.
Did America, when you were sitting in those chairs, ever contemplate similar action to what we're seeing now?
Certainly. Look, military strikes have been part of the possible decision-making to deal with the nuclear issue as well as other problems emanating from Iran for a number of years. President Obama actually ordered that the military plans to deal with Iran's nuclear program be updated because he was concerned they wouldn't be effective enough. So this has been part of the playbook. But it was always recognized that a decision to use military force would foreclose other options like diplomacy and would potentially result in significant damage being done both to the United States, our Gulf partners and allies, and to global economics. So, you know, we recognized the downsides of doing this, even if we recognized it was something that might have to be done to arrest a nuclear program that we thought could go to weapons.
But presumably under a former administration, the fallout wouldn't have been as extreme. Perhaps an end plan would have been mentioned. And also, and I'm so sorry to be parochial and bring it back to this country, there wouldn't have been such a chasm of dissent between America and the UK.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, even if we had military plans, we also would have had diplomatic plans. We would have had sanctions plans. We would have had economic plans. If you look at, you know, the campaigns that have been undertaken in the past, they've been with the totality of national power being applied. And that includes, of course, working with our partners and allies. I think what the prime difference that I see in what the United States has done now, as opposed to what it's done in the past, is a complete disregard for allies to the second, third, and fourth tier consequences, and an unwillingness to think about what the adversary can do and how they might not just fold. And again, to be clear, I'm convinced that the professional people at the Department of Defense, Department of State, know all these things. I've worked with them for a number of years. I just don't think they were listened to at a political level.
Yeah. Now, we're fascinated by that because it does seem extraordinary that all of the intelligence, all of the knowledge, all of the experience was simply not listened to. Where does that leave that connection between Donald Trump and all of those essential parts of the administration?
Well, it's interesting. So historically, there have been times where the real experts have been disconnected from decision making. I think there are people who would argue that in advance of the Iraq War in 2003, that their expertise was ignored in favor of, you know, those with maybe less expertise or certain political positions. I think what you saw in the Bush administration over the course of it was a greater recognition of the role that expertise could provide, the value that civil servants, whether in the intelligence community or the State Department or elsewhere, could provide, and a desire to bring those people into the process. I am not convinced that that is going to be the trajectory of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think that may be an understatement, if I may say so. Turning to your more recent role working on anti-corruption efforts for Joe Biden, we have seen repeated trades in prediction markets ahead of some very key decisions by this administration. Is that something that in your old role targeting corruption you would have thought merited a bit more investigation, a bit more light on it?
No, without a doubt. You know, it is a potentially devastating blow to the credibility of the United States to have these sorts of things going on. And it absolutely undermines any faith and confidence that one can have in one of its leaders that they're making decisions on the basis of national interest. You know, when you're conducting trades on foreign policy decisions you have a role in, that's almost as definitional an insider trading problem as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And it really tarnishes, I think, the credibility of the U.S. government to have these things going on.
How would you investigate that? How do you investigate that? Is it always possible to trace that kind of a bet?
It's difficult. Look, and I think this is one reality that we're all working on in the anti-corruption space now is how much more complicated it is to follow these things in the current environment where you can, you know, make these sort of bets out of your phone and you can engage in financial transactions involving cryptocurrency and those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, you can have standards that simply say you are not allowed to engage in these sorts of conducts. and then to have rigorous financial disclosure requirements. So if you find someone has done something, you punish them, and you punish them with both administrative punishments. They can be fired, they can be fined, and potentially even prosecuted if they're found to be, using their official position for private gain, which is the very definition of corruption.
Would you go as far as to say that you think this is a corrupt administration?
Yes, I think so. And I think that there are plenty of very credible allegations that have been identified in the media going back for the almost the duration of this. Whether we're talking about business deals that have been made by members of the families of people who are in prominent political positions, whether we're talking about the rather overt business arrangements that are being made that could have direct benefit to the president. I think there are plenty of pieces of evidence to suggest that there are lots of actors in this administration who are engaged in corruption.
Why doesn't anything stick?
Well, I think that's a bigger issue when you come down to the politics of the United States and potentially to the way in which the Department of Justice and other investigators are able to operate. I actually just published an article with the organization Just Security, which outlined changes that have been made to the enforcement efforts at the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission, which shows that a lot of these investigators have been fired. A lot of the investigations themselves have been set aside. So I think there's a real problem with enforcement of these sorts of standards.
How do you see the current conflict in the Middle East ending? What are we realistically able to foresee and hope for?
I think the most reasonable expectation we can have is that both sides will, over the course of the next maybe 2 or 3 weeks, decide that it is better to have a ceasefire than not. And I don't think that'll come with a lot of terms. I don't think it'll come with a lot of verification. There will literally just be a ceasing of fire. And I think that that can be brokered by a number of the mediators who are involved now, whether you're talking about the Pakistanis, talking about the Egyptians. And I think that ultimately it's not going to be satisfying because it won't result in a comprehensive deal, but that will at least allow, oil and gas and fertilizer and other things to start moving through the Straits of Hormuz and potentially in abeyance of some of the active military conflict.
Do you keep in touch with Joe Biden and his team or at least those close to him? And if so, how is he?
I can't say. I've not spoken with the president or with people who are spent a lot of time with him. I'm just following him through the media, but he seems like he's in good spirits.
Thank you very much. That's Richard Nephew, who was the US Deputy Special Envoy to Iran and served as Joe Biden's coordinator on global anti-corruption efforts.
Donald Trump is still talking at the cabinet meeting. He's moved on to his anti-crime initiatives in major American cities. He had looked a bit sleepy earlier on, but he's perked up a little bit in the last couple of minutes.
He had a full-fat Coca-Cola.
I think he might have done. Right, sport next with Vassos. Rising through the football ranks, all well and good, until the fans have to give up their share in the club. That's next with Vassos. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Ilan Goldenberg is a former special advisor to the US administration covering Iran and the Middle East. He'll help us get inside the mind of Donald Trump as we look at what's ahead. And our newsmaker is Oded Elam. He's former head of the counterterrorism division for Mossad as we look into Benjamin Netanyahu's wider strategy for Israel's security in the Middle East.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Feel that? That little buzz of excitement, that's the weekly flutter. With chances to win up to £10,000, enter British Heart Foundation's lottery for a thrill with goodwill behind it. Because when you play, it helps fund life-saving research. So go on, keep playing, keep winning, keep us beating. Search BHF Lottery. Gamble responsibly, over 18s only. T's and C's apply. Please see our website for more details. British Heart Foundation is a registered charity.
First time in premium economy, you'll double check your ticket. Second time, you'll wonder why you waited. Third time, you'll never go back. With generous legroom, Wi-Fi and dishes by Michelin-starred chefs, you'll feel like Asia just got closer. Cathay Pacific, move beyond.
This was made with human intelligence.
And artificial intelligence.
Just like Intuit QuickBooks business management software. If you're a sole trader earning over 50K from April 2026, making tax digital means...
you have to file your taxes online.
But new QuickBooks AI has
automated tools to help make compliance easier.
I was going to say that. Outdo it with Intuit QuickBooks.
McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11 a.m, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wickes. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Some other highlights from Donald Trump. He says he's a dog person. I don't know where that fits in. I'm just reading the subtitles. But he's also just been discussing at some length the dimensions and general wonderment of the new White House ballroom. So don't panic, everybody. He's just in charge of the free world. Now, have you heard, Fee, of parental differential treatment?
Well, I'm assuming that I know what it is.
Yes. PDT.
Yeah.
It's whether parents have a favourite child. And I'm mentioning that because our guest after 3.30 is Catherine Carr, author of Who's the Favourite? The Loving, Messy Realities of Sibling Relationships.
Do you think your parents had a favourite?
Very much so. Don't you seem starting me off?
And do you have a favourite?
Yeah, no.
No, you see, that's the thing. Yeah, nobody says yes to that.
No, but I don't know. Is it that you are... I mean, it's interesting because some of the research suggests that I'm just quoting from the book. Parents lavish more attention and praise on the child who is struggling, keen to make up for a kind of perceived shortfall. So actually more fuss is made of the child who perhaps isn't excelling because parents entirely legitimately want to give them a bit of support.
Yeah, but, you know, squeaky wheels get the most grease.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, if you feel that you haven't been favoured by your parents, get a therapist. Right, let's... I actually thought Bastos was coming in the room. That's why I was just filling Felix.
He's on Zoom.
Nobody tells me anything.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think he's probably the oldest of three.
Let's ask him. Vassos, have you got siblings?
What on earth makes you say that, Fee? And yes, I am. I am the oldest of three.
Oh, my goodness.
You're
that was
witch.
An absolutely random guess.
Okay.
I don't know why I said that.
Right. Let's talk about community-owned AFC Wimbledon, which has risen through the non-league tiers. It's got to League One. But now the club's at quite an interesting point. Because the wealthy owners of clubs like Portsmouth and Wrexham mean Wimbledon can't compete on the same level when it comes to wages and transfers. So it's raising the question, is it time to open the door to those with deeper pockets than, frankly, the fans? Because just explain, community-owned means what in terms of AFC Wimbledon, Vassos?
It absolutely means community-owned. AFC Wimbledon has about 7,500 owners. Sam Cunningham, writing in the Times today, he puts it rather nicely. It was the great phoenix from the ashes story. So there was Wimbledon FC, the crazy gang who won the FA Cup in 1988. John Motson's famous commentary, the crazy gang have beaten the culture club. And it was the rags to riches story. But then They were edged out of their Plough Lane ground. They had to ground share with Crystal Palace, and they were still a top flight club. And then the owners decided they wanted to move to Milton Keynes and buy a new stadium. And there was absolute outrage from fan groups, but it happened. Eventually they got it through a court case and Wimbledon FC was no more. Wimbledon FC, rather like NFL franchises move, became NK Dons. But then there's a guy called Ivor Heller, a lifelong Wimbledon fan, who conceived the idea to start afresh and roused support. They expected, writes Sam, 20 people to turn up to a fan meeting in a community centre in Wimbledon to discuss whether to start again. But more than 150 arrived. The building was packed to the rafters. They thought a few hundred players might show up for the trials. They stopped counting at 400. They re-entered as the now AFC Wimbledon in the ninth tier of English football, and they got promoted, and they got promoted, and yeah, they got promoted. And to their immense satisfaction, they are now a league above MK Dons.
Oh, wow. Well, no wonder they're chuffed with that. Mm. But it is difficult because of all the Hollywood money that's coming into, well, certainly Wrexham.
Yes, and Birmingham City last season, I remember they spent 15 million quid on a striker from Fulham, actually, called Jay Stansfield. And the previous League One transfer record was £4 million. Birmingham City also kind of Hollywood-owned or part Hollywood-owned. And the same Ivor Heller is quoted in the Times today saying football is out of control. The average loss, he says, this is, I didn't know this, the average loss in League One is £6 million a year. He calls that unsustainable, which it clearly is, and insane, which it clearly is. So what they've had to do, MK Dons, AFC Wimbledon, don't get those two confused, is rally the 7,500 owners and say, look, we're going to vote. Should we dilute the fan ownership of the club to 50.01%, which actually is the sort of model they use in Germany, and it works quite well. They voted overwhelmingly on Monday night to do that. So basically freeing up shares to get funds to keep the club competitive.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So we'll watch that with some interest over the coming years. Let's talk about football in Liverpool and Mo's gone or is going at the end of the season. I think his last game could be potentially a somewhat underwhelming encounter, with no disrespect. I think it might be Brentford. which, you know, I don't know whether it's quite... unless they get to the final of the Champions League, which is... possibly not nailed on.
Which is possible.
Yes, it's possible.
It is possible. It is possible.
And now fans are reeling because season tickets are going up. But I always think that, I don't think Liverpool season tickets were amongst the most expensive, were they? In fact, nowhere near.
No, absolutely not. And actually, reading about this in the Times today, because Liverpool are one of the supporters groups that are most vocal about ticket prices going up. And Liverpool do make pretty much as anybody. Manchester United and Liverpool are about the same. They make £4.5 million per match day. And it's become, I mean, it's a great tourist attraction to come to Anfield. And that's one of the sticks that Everton fans tend to beat Liverpool fans about. You know, it's because like they're all tourists at Anfield. And the supporters board have said it's extremely disappointing that Liverpool ticket prices are going to go up, in line with inflation, capped at 5% over the next 3 years. So adult ticket prices will rise between £3 and £4.50. Season tickets between, I don't know, £55 and £70. But here is the thing, sort of in defence of Liverpool, they do have, and they have capped junior tickets at £9 for 11 seasons running, and they will continue to do that. And they have something called local general tickets available to those with a Liverpool postcode. And I think they're the same price as the junior tickets. So, you know, they are giving back as well.
Yeah, OK. I mean, it is true that certainly if I get the train to Liverpool on a Saturday when Liverpool are at home, the train is full of, how can I phrase it, plastic Scousers travelling to the game.
it is amazing. I mean, as a fan of a club that is sort of yo-yos down, up and down between the Premier League and not Fulham. Right. So when we're in the Championship, everyone there is a Fulham fan, and the ground sometimes is full and sometimes isn't full. The ground is always full in the Premier League, but sometimes you'll find somebody sitting in your seat and you'll go, excuse me, sir, ma'am, that's my seat. No, I think it is, and I think this is where we're meant to be sitting. Well, except that we've been sitting there every match for 10 years and I know the names of everybody around you. I think that is my seat. You do find more tourists in the Premier League. Of course you do. The other thing that the fans group would say is that Liverpool announced record revenues recently of £703 million. So they would like some of that plowed back into ticket prices.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just worth noting that the players don't do badly. Mo Salah was on, what, £400,000 a week? I mean, it's a lot of
money.
Yeah,
it is a lot of money, but you know, costs are going up. They pay a lot of money to agents as well. I mean, they're one of the clubs who have paid the most millions to agents, all licensed agents, and they all have to declare it all. But yes, there's a lot of money swishing around football, and the fans say, well, the more the ticket prices go up, the less it's a communal fan experience. And that is something to worry about, because football isn't like any other business in that respect.
And if you
wonder about that, watch the original documentary about football, which is called Sunderland Till I Die. It's much more about what the club means to the community as it is about anything else. And that really tells you how the club has its roots in the community, and it has done for more than 100 years, Liverpool included.
Thank you, Vassos. Vassos is with us Monday to Thursday at around this time. If you want more on any of these sports stories we've discussed, you can go to thetimes.com and head to the sports section.
Coming up, how being a first, middle or last child or an only child rules your personality. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines. It's just gone 3:30. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's telling Tehran to get serious soon about negotiating a deal to end the war or face continued US bombardment. A senior Iranian official has called the American plan to end the conflict one-sided, but says indirect talks are continuing. Elsewhere, Keir Starmer took more than 2 months to give the green light for Britain's special forces to seize sanctioned Russian oil tankers. The Times understands it left UK troops to act merely in a support role to the French. Senior military sources have described the government as adrift, while others have said John Healey, the defence secretary, is keeping key figures out of the loop on long-delayed defence investment plan, which is crippling decision-making. Major General Tim Cross, a retired British Army officer and military logistics expert, says what's needed now is action.
I'm really pleased that we're refocusing back on Ukraine. And the danger is, frankly, if Ukraine goes badly wrong and Iran goes badly wrong, then we in the West will be even weaker than we currently are. And the Prime Minister so talking about these two fronts is absolutely the right thing to do. Although I have to say that our limited resources in what we can get up to is, you know, worrying. You know, we need less, without being hard on him, we need less speeches and more resources going into our military capabilities to enable us to do this stuff.
Trans athletes born male will be banned from competing as females from the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles. Eligibility for any IOC event will now be limited to biological women, determined by a one-time screening process. Treasury-backed savings giant NS&I is preparing to pay out hundreds of millions of pounds. A new leadership team's also in place after a series of blunders meant bereaved families missed out on money due. The number of sewage spills into England's rivers, lakes and seas dropped by more than a third last year. Official figures also show they typically lasted half as long. And Sir Paul McCartney has released a new single and announced his first album for 5 years. The Boys of Dungeon Lane recounts memories from the singer's formative years in Liverpool. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with support to sell to the world. James Markey is a technology entrepreneur with Unisim and an export champion for the Department for Business and Trade.
Hi, I'm James. I created a portable training simulator for dental and medical students. It uses haptics, which is virtual touch, and VR so they can practice safely before treating real patients. In 2019, Adema University in Mallorca bought 8 of these straight away, but I didn't really have a clear path to grow internationally. Then I was introduced to a local government-backed initiative supporting business growth. It helped us fund a portable prototype and connected me to the UK government's Department for Business and Trade. That support changed everything. Unisim's now a six-figure exporter, 90% of that overseas. For us, export support wasn't just a nice extra. It really has been transformational.
To find out more about how your company could benefit from UK government support, visit business.gov.uk.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
24 minutes to 4 o'clock.
This is an easy one. It's 25 to four.
It's not, though.
Missed it.
No, it's the one after that. 24 minutes to four. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. John Pienaar mercifully takes over at 4 o'clock. And we've got our Christmas dinner tonight, so we're looking forward to that. It was postponed before the great day, so we're doing it tonight. And Fee's got a mouthful of mini egg, so yeah, she's already nice. Celebrating.
Yeah.
Now, this is partly because our guest, Catherine Carr, came in with some gifts for us, some mini eggs. She's the author of Who's the Favourite? The Loving, Messy Realities of Sibling Relationships. Now, as the blurb to the book says, Catherine, our sibling relationships are the longest we'll ever have. But that doesn't mean they are without complication. And that's true, isn't it?
That's totally true, because they're unlike any other relationship, I think. And that's what's so interesting, is I heard you saying just before I came on air, you know, you have birth order, oldest, middle baby, and maybe more. So your relationship starts sort of vertical, they're hierarchical. And then unlike any other relationship in your life, they sort of can evolve over all of those decades, maybe 8 or 9 decades, into something more equitable and peer-like. And that's quite a shift.
And it can be a challenge.
And it often doesn't happen. People have their sort of roles and their labels and their identities, part of which is birth order, but a lot of which is dictated by the circumstances that surround a family, like money or where they live, environment, health, all sorts of things. Mm. And sometimes they don't go beyond those. So when you're thrown back together, which can often happen in middle age as siblings to deal with aging parents and things like that, if you haven't really evolved beyond two-dimensional labels of who's the oldest, who's the responsible one, who gets away with murder, etc., that is a really fraught time. And the studies show that's when things can go really wrong.
It's absolutely fascinating. Now, Fee, is you're the eldest of... No, you're the youngest of two daughters.
Yes.
Yeah. And what are you, Catherine?
I'm the middle of three girls.
Right, and I'm the eldest of two daughters.
Here we are.
So, okay, and I would say it absolutely, emphatically has had an impact, the fact that I'm the elder of two girls. And have you ever met anybody who simply denies that their sibling relationships or their birth order has had the slightest impact on them?
Really interestingly, I have never met an oldest daughter who denies it. So I think where gender intersects with being the firstborn, particularly when you're talking about care, but also that kind of emotional caregiving or being slightly relied upon to look after the subsequent siblings or being responsible or being a little bit perfectionist and neurotic as a result. Obviously, in other cultures, being firstborn and maybe a girl or boy is completely different. So in some parts of the world, if you're the firstborn boy, you may be sent out to work really early and you don't get the chance to finish your education and do better, in inverted commas, like older siblings do sometimes in the West. But I think the oldest daughter thing is fascinating.
What about youngest daughter?
Well, the research for youngest children, it's interesting. You've got children, I've got children, you've got children. You know when you've got a toddler and a baby, for example, and you're generally more preoccupied with the toddler because developmentally they're into things, emptying the Tupperware drawer, whatever, and the baby might be plonked in a bouncy seat in the corner. That's sort of where I see it starting. You know, when you make eye contact with the baby who's just there, they almost make jazz hands and they make eye contact and they smile. They're kind of desperate for some of the attention and time and that you can give them. Mm. So I sort of... It's very simplistic to think it's just about that. But in your own family, with those circumstances around your own family, you are always relative. You are always in that order. And that does, I think, mean something.
Tell us about your own childhood and where it happened and how it all unfolded.
So I think my childhood is what predisposed me to be interested in siblings. So we moved to Holland when I was 6. There's 3 girls. So the oldest, Bex, 6, 7, 8-ish maybe, and the baby was 6 months old, CJ. And my dad worked in ice cream, which is cheerful.
We should say what he invented.
The Feast.
Yeah.
That's just... You're absolutely kidding.
No.
I don't know why I'm shilling like this.
No,
I shouldn't be working.
It's just fantastic.
He was in a team of 2 or something who came. It was basically how to get as much chocolate on a stick as possible.
Well, he succeeded. It's a magical ice cream.
He's an incredible man.
Yeah. We save some time at the end for talking about that.
Absolutely.
Carry on.
So we moved to Holland to do that, among other things. And when I was 11, my parents split up. Really common. What wasn't so common is that my mum left and my little sister went with her. So she was 6 at the time. I was 11. Bex was about 13. And not long after, my dad and me and my older sister moved back to the UK, leaving my mum and my little sister in Holland. So... there's a lot I could say about that, but really in terms of siblings, what it does is it really, exaggerates the separation that every sibling has in their childhood. Because even if you grow up together, your experiences are different. But if you grow up apart, your experiences are really, really different. Different countries, different parents, different biscuits, different bolognese recipe, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think what it did is made... I never take my sisters for granted. I think you can if you grow up together because you assume they'll always be there. I've never thought that. And we've worked really hard to be friends and to love each other in the way that we do and to be so close. So that's sort of where the idea, really the germ of the idea, came from.
Yes, and have there been other children as a result of your parents having other relationships?
No. So we gained stepsisters, a step three stepsisters and a stepbrother, but no halves.
Okay.
Otherwise known as cement babies.
Right, cement babies.
They might cement the new families together, you see.
I see. Gosh, I mean, you do try in the book to cover every possibility, including only children. Mm. And I do think, Fee and I were talking about this earlier, and there's just such a weight about that term, as though the individual bears some sort of responsibility for this when they have no say whatsoever. Who did you meet to hear about being an only child?
Oh, all sorts of people. But most interestingly, a psychotherapist called Louise Halling, who remembers growing up in the Borders in Scotland, quite Presbyterian, quite an environment. And she remembers being quite small and people bending down to her height when she was a little girl and just sort of saying one word in her face, spoiled. She was sort of, how do you know? You don't know any other experience when you're a child. You swim in the soup you swim in. You don't know any other environment. You don't know any other reality. And when you're older, I think it's bonkers to assume that having siblings could rescue you from being lonely and automatically make you happy, because sometimes and often they don't. And to assume the other, which is being an only child automatically means you're lonely, because the research shows actually only children are really good at making friends because they value close relationships.